Time for the weekend panel. And this morning we're joined by Josie Pagani with me in Auckland for a change, a commentator on current and international affairs. Morena.
Morena, Jim.
And in Wellington, Chris Wikaina, a director of the Wellington public relations firm BRG. Kia ora, Chris.
Kia ora, kōrua.
A highlight or lowlight from the past week from each of you to start, please. Josie.
I think my highlight is Scott Morrison, Jacinda Ardern meeting in Queenstown today, I think, and some indication that they're going to put more money into the Pacific. And, you know, I work in this area. The Pacific has just been absolutely devastated. The economies have been shot. You know, I mean, some countries, 70% of GDP is tourism. So this urgency, more than anything else, of actually needing to pivot to different sources of income for the Pacific. And I would like to see some kind of Western alliance, you know, like a New Zealand, Australia, US, France, whatever, that would kind of work together in collaboration and almost sort of, you know, match the influence of China in the Pacific. I think there's a huge potential. COVID has accelerated a whole heap of stuff that's quite positive, and that could be one of them.
I don't know about France, but wasn't there a localised alliance forming a couple of years ago to do this very thing?
Yeah, a little bit. But, I mean, you could even think of it as a sort of Pacific Union, Jim, you know, a bit like the EU, where you've got this you know, common legislation on biosecurity, because they're going to have to find alternative sources of income in the Pacific. Tourism's not coming back for a decade, I reckon.
A decade?
I reckon in the Pacific it's going to take a long time before people start to come back in the same numbers.
In the same numbers.
Before COVID.
Okay. Thank you, Josie. Chris, what's been on your mind, please?
Well, I had I found myself on Friday night at the Voyager Media Awards in Auckland, as ostensibly as somebody's plus one. And what surprised me, and gave me a few pangs and flashbacks of sitting in this chair right here last century, was the number of Māori stories that were being covered, the number of Māori journalists who were doing well in all facets of the media, and there was just, you know, there were brown people everywhere at the awards, and the camaraderie between everyone and the support for everyone was fantastic, because I thought back to when I started my journalism career that, you know, Māori issues were the brown elephant in the room that were always difficult, they were always awkward, they were generally negative, and I'm talking about inside the media, because no one wanted to do them, no one understood them, some in the newsroom were you know, viscerally hostile towards them. So I saw a generational sea change that warmed my heart.
The Māori Renaissance, I mean, we are seeing it in full flower, especially in the media areas you're talking about.
Absolutely, and it's just about the curtains being drawn back and everyone being a little more comfortable with each other and saying, hey, this is a big part of our country, let's just do it.
You know what, Chris, also, it's sort of, you remember how, you know, Māori news used to be sort of siphoned off into a sort of add-on at the end of the news, or, you know, it had its own little place. And it's like, well, you know, now that's completely gone, which is so fantastic. It's just, it's you don't have to be a Māori journalist doing just Māori news, right?
Oh, absolutely. And while it, there's still some discomfort for us all as a nation to go through, it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's not about people being entrenched into their corners. It's about actually, I lost my word there. It's actually about inclusion, not separatism, because we've heard so much about separatism recently.
Yeah, I'm going to get back to that and the discomfort shortly. The weather, we're out of it, but we'll talk to the three of us, but we'll talk to Richard Joseph, who's in it as we go, which means we might not get to everything we were going to get to, but I hope you don't mind. A new report from Otago University suggested a four-day work week to soften artificial intelligence job displacement. And the applause for this was muted. Questions. For either of your own paid work, does a four-day week make sense? We know it worked for Perpetual Guardian, for example. But do you suspect it only makes sense if you're able to clock in and clock out, and in many jobs you're simply on a lot of the time now?
You can be really flexible about it, though. I mean, for a start, I don't think robots are going to take our jobs. It used to be computers are going to take our jobs. You know, the Luddites, it was machines are going to take our jobs. I mean, the stats show that about, yes, the jobs are going to change. We're going to lose about, you know, 85 million jobs, they estimate. But we're actually going to create a whole bunch of new jobs, about 97
what,
million.
What, kind and caring and sharing jobs?
Yeah, information, communications. Data entry specialists will become a data analyst. You know, there's a financial analyst will become a project manager. You know, that the jobs will transition. But on the four-day week, Jim, I mean, some of the aid agencies I know have gone to 4 days. They've made the fifth day a gift. So it's not a right, but you can, if you need to catch up on work, you can. You can work from home on that fifth day, or you can do nothing. Even when you've got things like with aid agencies, telemarketing, people phoning up, you can't really do that at home. But you can look at it and go, what are the best times in the day to do telemarketing? So why don't you come in later and stay a bit later, do shorter days where you're going to get the most bangs for bucks. So I think you can go to 4 days with a bunch of jobs that you would think you couldn't. And you actually end up being more productive because you're just analysing when you're most effective.
You're talking flexi rather than 4 day per se, aren't you?
Not really. I mean, I think what it's showing is that you can find ways to give people an extra day for some reason and still be so as productive, because it might be that one day in the week is really bad for telemarketing.
Sure.
So do it 4 days.
Okay. Chris, do you have thoughts on this?
Well, this invoked a memory in the 90s, it would have been the late 1970s, my best mate Jeremy and I walking along East Street in Taumarunui talking about when we were this age and we would be living this George Jetson type lifestyle, because that's what was...
Where did the jetpacks go?
Yeah, we were going to be the leisure generation because all of the menial stuff like vacuuming and all of that was going to be done by automation of some sort. And we get here, and where is it?
Yes, exactly.
You know, so I reflect on that, and I'm a little bit cynical about it and go, really? Is this really going to happen?
I love it, Chris. In the 70s, you know, everything, quicksand was really bad. You know, and when I grew up, I thought that quicksand was going to be a much bigger problem than it's actually turned out to be. Do you remember all the movies we saw as kids? Quicksand was,
yes,
like,
yes, people were always
really,
struggling in quicksand.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So we had all these expectations.
And all the Indians were bad.
Yeah. Turns out, yeah, we're still working really, really hard and we haven't had all that leisure time. And quicksand's not such a big problem after all.
Maybe haven't seen it in a movie for years.
No, that's absolutely true. And maybe there'll be computer therapy jobs.
I think therapy will be a growth industry one way or another, Jim.
You're kind to the artificial intelligence. Speaking of your discomfort, not your own personal discomfort, but that word, Chris, ACT and the National Party suspect the concept and teaching of white privilege is being introduced to our schools. And David Seymour said a student at a Whangarei primary school had to stand up in the classroom and say what they'd done to acknowledge their white privilege. Do any aspects of this worry you? Chris,
yes,
you first.
Yes, absolutely. Because I don't think that's the right way to go about it. And I think this becomes a sideshow of what the real issue is. And that is, and it goes back to the history in schools issue. If we haven't been taught what the history of this country actually was and is, because it's evolving, it's a living thing, and we're making history now for our future generations to look back on and stroke their chins over and scratch their heads over, it goes back to that. And, you know, I note that both ACT and National were very reticent to actually have a genuine New Zealand history curriculum developed. I am concerned about these concepts. Putting labels on things like this is generally not helpful. What we're better to do is actually this is where things came from, and once you learn that, you can make up your own mind, and fair-minded, right-headed people will come to the right conclusion.
Josie Pagani.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, teaching New Zealand history, teaching about racism in New Zealand is really important. It's really good to see that. It's driven by, you know, this kind of thing is driven by good intentions. The problem is when you start talking about things like white privilege and you have this orgy of white shame, it becomes almost slightly narcissistic, you know, and I'm not sure that, you know, apologising for being white is doing anything to help Māori and help some of the issues that we need to confront.
So what's my left leg got to apologise to my right arm?
Yeah, exactly. And also, Chris, it frames Māori as victims, doesn't it? It frames Māori as fragile. And rather than talking, just what you said at the beginning of the show, talking about the success of Māori, about in business, in arts, in journalism, in politics. So I think be specific about the problem in education. You know, too many Māori on low income, okay. You know, overrepresented in prison. Be specific about the problem, and then you'll be specific about the solution.
Let me come back to this. It's 10 minutes to 9. Richard Joseph is joining us, the Mount Somers Rural Fire Force Chief, very kindly on what he's seeing this morning. Richard, good morning. Oh, we're not getting you loud and clear. We'll see if it improves as we go. You are out and about. Is it all hands on deck in Mount Somers?
Yeah, it's pretty wet out there. Lots of water flowing around. So, some people probably not being quite so careful, but there's a lot of water flowing here, so it will hit the town. It will. We're uphill of all the other major towns, so it'll all going downhill from here. So.
It's going downhill from Mount Somers down the Ashburton River. But what are you seeing in the town itself? Because we understand you've been pretty deluged. Are people having to cope with water in their homes or anything like that yet?
A little bit, there is a bit. Country people are pretty resilient, so not quite so bad, but there's water flowing everywhere, so it would be nice if it stopped.
It'd be nice if it stopped. Well, it won't for a while. You've had an awful lot, and you've got an awful lot to come. So, Richard, what are your main tasks today? What will they be, do you suspect? What do you think's going to happen that you and your team might have to cope with?
Basically, hopefully people do essential things and don't go places where they shouldn't.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's it in a nutshell. Okay, so you're out and about, you're on deck, and so I imagine a number of people just watching to see those river levels and watching to see those surface flooding levels and slips and such.
Yeah, that's correct. Yep.
All right. Good to talk with you. Thank you for sparing us the time, too. That's Richard Joseph, the Mount Somers Rural Fire Force Chief. Now, just getting back to that topic, and we thank him for his time, just getting back to that topic at 7 minutes to nine that we were... Education consultant Dr. Anne Milne told the New Zealand Herald, there's one more aspect of this, really. It's not about white people per se, but whiteness as a system. One way to look at this is that you're walking down the street and you have a $10 note just put in your pocket for no reason. And the riposte has been that there are plenty of Pākehā children at school who also missed out on the $10 note.
Yeah, I mean, I come back to that stat of NCEA level 2 attainments, right? It's where 64% of Māori leave school with level 2 compared to about 82% of Pākehā. Where the difference comes is when you're teaching in Māori, so more than 50% in Māori, 80% of Māori come out with NCEA level 2. So then I think a much more constructive way to talk about this is to go, right, what does that actually mean? Does it help Māori for Pākehā kids to stand up and talk about their privilege? Or does it help Māori to hand over the resources, hand over decision-making to Māori and say it works better when you look after your own? And I think that's the thing, that if we're actually prepared to look at what some of the solutions that are working are, that's a much more constructive way than saying, you know, some white kid has got an extra $10 in their pocket.
Yeah, Chris, do you concur with that?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do. And the point I want, one thing that's really important in this whole debate, this is about and. It's not about replacing what someone has now with someone else's something, Māori usurping something that non-Māori currently have. It's an and argument, and that is the way forward. And if you look at the debate and the hand-wringing and shrieking from some quarters about our Māori Health Authority, again, Josie raises the point about education. Health stats are in the same boat. If you improve the basic areas of health where there are Māori overrepresentation, you save the country, that's for everybody, billions and billions of dollars. Now, what's been done so far has not worked. So let's do something different that might save the country billions of dollars that we can all spend on all sorts of other things.
Very good. Over 10 years, the average household rates bill in Auckland will go up from $2,810 to $4,018, and the average water bill from $1,069 to $2,261. But it'll be worth it, says Phil Goff.
And who hasn't watched the plight of Wellington and felt for Wellington as its wastewater, its stormwater and its freshwater pipes have exploded in the streets because they are long past the need for renewal?
Terrible for you people in Wellington.
Look, it took literally for sewage to be running in the streets before someone noticed that many councils, subsequent councils, have not dealt with the horizontal stuff, you know, the fresh water, the wastewater, the stormwater. And the problem is, I think Stephen Joyce had a piece in the Herald recently about this, that, you know, local elections, the candidates campaign on the sexy stuff, the stadiums, the cycle pathways, the film centres, museums, whatever. They don't campaign on fixing your pipes underground. No one's been doing that.
No.
So, you know, it's a shocking disregard for leadership in local government.
Chris, I just chose the top commenter on the New Zealand Herald website. Someone needs to get in there and cut out all the unnecessary spending, all the big vanity projects, the inflated salaries. They spend millions on totally unnecessary things and neglect the basics, and we've heard this before. So, more than 2,800 people who work for Auckland Council get paid more than $100,000 a year. Media now talk about a town hall rich list. Water care, 8 team members paid around $335,000. 3 other staff more than $250,000, and the departed CEO was more than $800,000. Do you think the salaries are tenable, Chris? Do you think it likely that more than 1 in 5 Auckland City employees deserve to earn more than $100,000 a year?
I don't want to immediately jump to the other side of the fence and say they don't deserve that, because I don't quite know what their jobs are and what they're doing. I would have thought working in any organisation, whether it's council or a new entity as proposed by the government to try and sort this mess out, is going to have to be pretty highly skilled, because I've got a hell of a job to do. And I think Gough's being a little bit sneery with his Wellington example, because it was Wellington that actually took the lead in the 1990s when they contracted out East Anglian Water from the UK to build the Moore Point sewage plant, because, you know, we had that terrible situation of at times pretty much raw sewage just being pumped out into the Cook Strait. And who can remember on a beautiful calm day in the Cook Strait you'd fly into Wellington and see the big brown stain out the right hand side window if you're on a northerly approach. But at that time, the chief engineer of the Wellington City Council warned that I think the sum was something like $4 million a year had to be put aside to deal with the ageing infrastructure that was at risk of failure. That was 1995, and it takes until the last 18 months or so when it finally fails for the council to do something. So we were well ahead, and we were well behind, but Auckland's no different. And Watercare, if you look at Watercare, one of the things they're saying, well, we've got to take more water from the Waikato River. They were in a water crisis last summer, and they couldn't stop people water blasting and using hoses, and so they've got to get their own house sorted out. So maybe that's where they start with the big salaries.
Yes, well, they're earning the big salaries. Before we go, the National Māori Authority demanding a halt on licences for new bottle stores because of increasing street violence. And I thought this was important to mention. Māori wardens patrolling the Auckland CBD seeing multiple vicious alcohol-fuelled attacks every weekend. We've heard about Wellington as well. Warden Thomas Henry says there's a turf war developing on the streets late at night where big violent groups stick together and are on the lookout for anyone they don't like coming too close.
It is bad. It is bad. We need to do something about it. We need to stop. I think there's enough liquor stores now that we've got in the Auckland Central area.
And I was going to have Nikki Jackson as well, but I won't have time to play her clip. But she says the appeals process is stymieing councils and their bids to impose local alcohol policies. Do you think even supermarkets should be selling alcohol, let alone spending millions of dollars opposing restrictions on its sale?
Well, I think supermarkets should stop whining about it, because they had a complete monopoly during COVID of selling alcohol to us when everything else was closed, and now they're, you know, whining about it again. I mean, look, I think it's a bigger problem than that. I think I remember writing a speech for Jim Anderton years ago, and the stats are still the same. 60% of people arrested are under the influence of alcohol, according to the police. 75% of domestic violence incidents,
yeah.
alcohol-induced. So something needs to happen, and the legislation makes it hard for local communities to go, actually, in this particular community, there are too many liquor stores, and
yes.
we've got an extra problem. It shouldn't be that hard. But
okay.
supermarkets need to stop appealing this stuff. Yeah. I mean, come on.
Just quickly, Jim, to add to that, I think it should be on the basis of organisations like Marty Ward's opinions, not competitors like supermarkets.
Very good. Chris Wikaita, sorry to cut you both short this morning, but of course, a big weather situation to talk about. Chris Wikaita, Josie Pagani on the weekend panel. Thank you, and nice to see you in person, Josie.
Hey, good night.